From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. Here's a riddle for you. What's something that's hard to predict, impossible to control, yet vital to everyone on the planet? It's weather. And for the vast majority of us, we know so little about the science, technology, and experts who study weather and try to give us the best information about what it will do. Today on the show, we'll bring you just such an expert, a professor at OSU and the state's chief climatologist. He'll talk about how weather forecasts are made, why they vary greatly, and why Oregon is such a difficult state in which to make weather predictions. And as a climatologist, he'll explain the vital differences between weather and climate and how our changing climate is making weather forecasting even more difficult. That's next on Oregon on the Record. Weather forecasting can be perplexing, but also vital to our daily lives. Today on the show, Oregon's climatologist talks about the science and art of weather forecasting in our age of climate change. Larry O'Neill, the state of Oregon's climatologist and also an associate professor at Oregon State University. Larry, always good to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Boy, let's start with a real basic one. How is a weather forecast developed?
That's a great question. And modern weather forecasts basically start with observations of the weather. So that seems pretty simple. Mm-hmm. We use a lot of different types of observations, and those come from satellites, radars, ground-based weather stations, weather balloons, and buoys out in the ocean. And basically what we try to do with that is just to get a snapshot of what the current weather is right now. And that is absolutely essential to know what the weather is now before we can say what a forecast will do. And then once we have that, modern weather forecasts now really utilize a lot of weather forecast models. And over time, those forecast models have become quite skillful, especially out to about 5 to 7, maybe even 10 days. And what those models do is they take basically all our the physics of what we know how the atmosphere works. Mm-hmm. So the atmosphere is a fluid. It's filled with air. And we know quite well how the atmosphere changes its temperature, how it changes its wind, and how it produces clouds and precipitation and all those sort of things. And so weather forecast models are absolutely essential to modern weather forecasting.
Okay. All those diagnostic tools you just described, the buoys, satellite imagery, do things happen between when, say, that buoy says the wind speed is 12 miles an hour and or the wave height is X? What happens between when weather hits those diagnostic tools and maybe a couple days later? What sort of happens? I mean, because obviously weather isn't a linear progression, is it? Things can change in a matter of hours, right?
Yeah. And that's right. And that's why we collect those observations initially, is to figure out where, you know, what the weather is doing at this minute. And based on our knowledge, you know, our vast knowledge of how weather works, we're able to find out, for instance, what the jet stream is doing. So where are the high and low pressure systems? That tells us a great deal about what, you know, what we can expect. So if you know, some part of our observing system sees that there's a hurricane or a strong cold front coming through or something like that. Based on all of our past experience with looking at that sort of data, we can find out, you know, we can see that, oh, okay, areas to the east of a big cold front, you know, might experience that cold front, or areas in the path of a hurricane might experience hurricane conditions. And so those are really very important parts of it. And it takes a lot of experience to try to, to interpret those observations. And then those observations are also fed into our computer models for what we can expect in the next few days. And so that really helps out our predictive capabilities, basically. So, you know, we initially diagnose what the initial state of the weather is, and then we try to predict it out to a few days based on those, on that diagnostic.
Okay. How good are predictive models thusly? Is it Boy, you know, for the last 30 years, on March 9th, the average temperature for Eugene has been 45 degrees. And I mean, I imagine that's helpful, but obviously just because it was that the last 30 years doesn't mean it's going to be tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right. So what you're referring to is that, you know, one of the also a really useful tool for weather forecasting is just what we call climatology. And that's exactly as you said, is that it's the, you know, what has the weather been on this day for the last 30 years or something like that. And so that kind of gives us you know, even before we look at the weather maps and look at the forecasts and things like that, that gives us a really good idea about, you know, what we can expect, you know, what the historical spread has been over time. And so that really kind of tempers our expectations for what we can expect as a forecast. And so, you know, we look at, and those that climatology actually really is useful for interpreting both the observations and the model forecasts. And I'll use an example, we had that heat dome event in 2021, in June of 2021, you know, forecasts, you know, 7 to 10 days out actually did quite well at foreseeing that event. However, running up to the event, the temperature forecast of like 115 or 100, you know, 116 that we got in Portland, the models kind of latched onto that really well, but it was so far outside of our historical norm that we were really nervous that the models were, you know, incorrect, that the models were, you know, way outside of things. And it turns out that they were actually quite good. However, there have been other instances where models have, you know, forecast maybe something not quite that bad, but something that was just outside of our normal range of understanding. And so knowing what the climatology is for the region can help us interpret whether, you know, maybe the forecast model is, you know, not doing well or something like that.
Okay. Let me quickly reintroduce you to the audience. We're talking with Larry O'Neill. He is the state of Oregon's climatologist as well as an associate professor at OSU. You were talking about the climatology for a region. I'm wondering, does Oregon present its own set of challenges, i.e., is it more interesting, more challenging to be a climatologist or a meteorologist in Oregon versus something like San Diego?
Absolutely. And one of the things that makes Oregon so challenging is we have a vast difference in climate across the state. So in the western part of the state, you know, from the crest of the Cascades to the west, you know, we have a very wet climate for the most part. And it, you know, and there's some geographic variations and stuff, but the coastal mountains, the Cascades, they get, you know, over 100 to 150 inches of precipitation per year. And then in the Cascades, we obviously get a lot of snowfall, typically, maybe not this year, but typically we do. And then once you go off to the east of the Cascades, you go out to Bend, and, you know, there's still 2/3 of the state from that part forward. And a lot of that part of the state is what we characterize as a semi-arid climate. And so it's not quite a desert, but it's getting there. It's really dry, and it could be really... the temperature variations can be quite vast, from really low temperatures to really high temperatures. So the coldest temperatures that have been found in the state have been in the eastern part of the state. I think our record low for the state is something like minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
And then the highest temperature also occurring in the eastern part of the state is 121 degrees Fahrenheit. And so there's just these vast variations that, and then along with that is that we have a lot of mountain ranges. So we have a lot of, we have the Blue Mountains, the Lawas in eastern Oregon. Obviously, we have the Cascades, but then we have all these other kind of minor mountain ranges, you know, the Steens Mountains, the Ochocos, things like that. And so that creates a lot of variability. And I would classify Oregon as one of the, the state with one of the most variable climates of all the states in the country.
Wow. Can we predict drought? And within that question, can you kind of explain the El Nino and La Nina effects and that impact on us here in Oregon typically?
Yeah, those are great questions. And I could talk a lot about those, but I'll just try to be really brief about it. So as far as the drought question is that we have difficulty predicting drought. And the reason is, we have difficulty predicting precipitation out past about 2 or 3 weeks ahead of time. And so, drought is kind of like this slow moving natural disaster, you could call it. And so we could see drought develop in real time, but it's really difficult to say, 2 or 3 weeks in advance if we're going to be wetter or drier than normal. Amount of rain that we've gotten over the last couple months is, can be made up for with one or two really good storms going forward. There is one aspect of drought that we can see coming, and that is when we have really low snowpack. And so low snowpack is often associated with spring and summer drought. So, and that's easy to see because, snowpack is a natural reservoir for water. And so when it's not there, when we get to April, then we are reasonably certain that in spring and summer, that we'll have really low stream flows, low reservoir levels in snow-dominated basins, things like that. And so that does give a little bit of element of predictability. And right now, we have one of the lowest snowpacks in our state's recorded history. And so we're reasonably certain if these conditions continue that we'll have water supply problems coming into the spring and summer.
Yeah. And then what about El Nino and La Nina, a term we hear a lot, but maybe some of us just don't simply understand it as well as we could.
Yeah, and that includes the experts as well, I might say. we do struggle with this, but the reason that we use El Nino and La Nina and we pay attention to it is simply that it's about one of the only tools or relationships that we have that can predict anything going out past a few weeks. And for Oregon, El Niños tend to occur, when El Nino occurs, we tend to be drier and warmer than normal. And when we have La Niñas, we tend to be wetter and cooler than normal. And so there's a lot of variations between different events, different years with that. But it gives us one of the only predictive capabilities that we have for trying to, see what's going to happen in the next couple of months. And things like, our weather forecast models and things like that, when we try running them out past, a few weeks, they're extremely uncertain. And, we often technically call it that they don't have very much skill. And what we mean by that is basically we can't trust them past a few weeks out. And there have been a lot of advances and work trying to increase that so that we can increase the predictability further out, because that would be a major benefit for us. But right now, it still remains kind of a very elusive problem.
I know some people might, they might turn on the TV for the weather report and see a grouping of temperature predictions and precipitation. They might also pull up their app on their phone and see the same thing. And sometimes they're not exactly aligned. Is that just simply because the weather reports are constantly updating? Is that kind of why you might see some differential in different mediums with their weather report?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it, is that the forecasts are updated constantly, both the weather service and then the models in which they rely on for those forecasts are run in real time, and they're run constantly. So, and there are a number of large numerical weather prediction centers that run these models, and they run them continuously. So, and they update them about every 6 to 12 hours. There are a few models that are updated more frequently, but that is definitely a source of difference that you might see in different weather apps or different weather graphics and things like that. We also have, like I said, a lot of different models that we rely on and a lot of different producers of weather information, weather forecast information, may rely on different models or different combinations of models, different combinations of forecasts, things like that.
Okay.
But the other thing about forecasts is that they are not absolute. They're what we call probabilistic. And so we try to just get a range. And so we definitely say that, okay, forecasts, you know, we can never have a perfect forecast. But what is really useful is if we have a range of what like the temperatures will be or how much rain there'll be or something like that. And often weather apps and things like that will present things in what seem like absolute terms. But really what we have is a range, you know, so we say it's going to be 60 degrees today. You know, what we really mean is something like, oh, it could be like 57 to 63 or something like that.
I see. Can you explain the difference between weather and climate?
Yeah. So this is a great one. And so weather is basically, what we experience and what we remember over short periods of time. So on the period, you know, on the time scales of maybe a few weeks or, you know, a couple months or something like that. That's what we kind of term the weather timescale. And so weather is all about the individual storm systems that you experience, the individual heat waves, the individual things that you would normally see. So climate is, once you get to a climate timescale, you get to collections, you know, seasons, years, decades. So that's so that combines together a lot of different individual weather systems and things like that. And it starts, the climate is really, when we talk about climate, we really mean the general weather patterns that we get, the general heating and cooling, the general precipitation, whether we get rain or snow, whether we kind of, you know, occasionally get lightning or tornadoes or things like that. That's really the climate time scale.
Okay. Is climate change making weather forecasting harder?
Yes, it is. And the reason it is because, and I alluded to this earlier, but I'll repeat it again. One of the things about weather forecasting that we, one of the key things of weather forecasting is the climatology of a region. So it's what we expect, the temperature patterns we expect, the precipitation patterns, the, you know, whether we get rain, snow, tornadoes, all this stuff. And with climate change is that we're seeing that what we experienced in the past is not what we're experiencing now. And so it's making us a lot more uncertain as to when we get a forecast, for instance, that heat dome forecast, whether that is a realistic forecast or is it, you know, something, is a model picking up something about climate change that we're just not seeing. And so it definitely is making weather prediction a little bit harder, especially in extreme weather events. So extreme precipitation events, extreme temperature events, and extreme things like hurricanes or tornadoes or things like that. Those are all making it harder because we're less able to rely on our past experiences to inform us about present and future decisions.
Okay. Larry, my last question for you, it's really a two-part question, but you know, and you and I have talked previously about some concern around cuts to federal programs that feed into the ability to forecast weather. And so I kind of wanted to check in with you on how things are going with regard to that. And then also to remind folks how important weather modeling and weather forecasting is. Yes, of course, for us, it's, oh, should we go play golf today? But no, it's going to rain. Talk about how important this is to our way of life, our economy, that sort of a thing.
Yeah. And I'll start by saying that our weather and our weather observing system. So that's kind of how we, you know, describe just a lot of the different assets that, you know, measure weather conditions and stuff like that. So it comes from ground-based observations through satellite observations and weather balloons and things like that. And it's been a very challenging time, basically, in the last year, with a lot of uncertainty with the federal cuts. One of the things we've had to do is to basically advocate for this system that we have and its importance in our weather prediction and, and how much it really impacts our society, our economy, our, obviously recreation, what we do, things like that. And there have been a number of, these threats to various parts of the system, coming from people who don't quite understand how vital weather observations are. And that includes our weather balloons. So a lot of the weather service offices all across the country launch several weather balloons a day, and those are really important. And we've had to discontinue some of those launches. There's actually some uncertainty about exactly how much, how many balloons and stuff that we've had that haven't been able to go up and stuff like that. But those sort of things have an effect on our weather forecasts. There have also been satellite missions that have been delayed or canceled, Earth science satellite missions, and or there have been some that have been under threat, and that's been very worrying, and they continue to be under threat.
Larry O'Neill, he's the State of Oregon climatologist, as well as an associate professor at Oregon State University. Larry, it's always great, if not sobering, to talk to you. Thanks so much for jumping on and having a conversation with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Tomorrow on the show, a conversation with Amy Green of The Oregonian about a bill that just passed the legislature that could be a vital lifeline to Oregon's struggling ski industry. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.